This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Unscrewed, the show that knows that real liberation includes sexual liberation. I am Jacqueline Friedman. Welcome back to the show. This week, in case you have not noticed, Valentine's Day is fast approaching. And if you haven't noticed, please tell me your secrets. And so I thought it was an appropriate time to sort of take a step back from all the propaganda and get real about, like, what is love? Like, insert whatever music cue that brings to mind for you here. But it's a big question, and we don't talk about it often enough. And I happen to have as a guest someone who's written a whole book and spent a lot of time thinking about the nature of love and is here to guide us through this conversation. Welcome to the show, Carrie Jenkins.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So you are a writer and a philosopher, a professor of philosophy, and your new book is called What Love Is and What It Could Be. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
That's a big brief, man.
Yeah, I like to think big.
That's a bold task you set for yourself. But before we get to it, as you know, since you are a listener of this show, we have to go through the lightning round. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So what's been making you the happiest this week?
I'm a big podcast fan. And so this week I was listening to the first episode of the second season of a podcast that I really love called Buffering the Vampire Slayer. Do you know this podcast?
No, but I'm a big Buffy fan. Buffering the Vampire Slayer?
You need to know about this podcast. Yes, it's called Buffering the Vampire Slayer. And it's two women who are married, as in married to each other and not to other people. And they have a conversation about each episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in turn. So you can watch along with them. And they do amazing things, like they give out a sexual tension award for each episode. And they mention the patriarchy once per show. And one of them is a musician and writes and performs a little song at the end of the podcast about what happened in that episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
How do I not know about this? It sounds like designed specifically for me.
It is wonderful, and they're brilliant and adorable, and I love this podcast.
All right, what is the best sex advice you've ever received?
To stop calling only very specific kind of sexual act sex. So there was a time when I was really in the swing of that and thinking, you know, a penis has to go into a vagina or it's not sex. Sex didn't happen. And so I had this piece of advice actually from the guy I later married to say, no, that's not what sex is. That's not what the word means. Seems like such a little thing, like a word, but it's actually huge because it shifts your perspective. It's actually more about the concept than it is about the word. It shifts your perspective on what the whole process is.
He sounds like a quality man. That's good you married him.
He's a quality man. Yes, that's a good description.
What is the sexuality news that's been making you the maddest or saddest lately? And I should say for listeners, we're recording this a bit in advance. So
I mean, this is tough because I'm finding it hard to have emotions about news anymore. After the end of last year, it's been really tough to recover what I would think of as a normal emotional response to what's happening in the world.
Mm.
So I was just reading about these Senate votes to try to keep coverage for various kinds of reproductive health care when the Affordable Care Act gets repealed. But I mean, so there's all that sort of thing. But there's also a little local thing that's happening. My university, which is that a guy called John Furlong, who was, he'd been invited to give a very sort of prominent talk at the university. He's a guy who's been accused by multiple people of abusing indigenous children at a school in the 1970s, right? So, you know, giving him this huge platform is sending a certain kind of message. And the UBC had actually cancelled his invitation under pressure from activists. You know, that was a really interesting decision, a really interesting move. But then what's just happened this week is that the president of the university has stepped in and re-invited him. And he's re-accepted, so he's coming.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, I think saddest would be the best response that I could use to describe what's happening to me as a result of this. And, you know, over the protest of my Indigenous colleagues at the university who seem to be just being ignored in these discussions, and it's really distressing. And then after that, just to add insult to injury, we get an email round to the university saying it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month at our university. I'm like, well, yeah, okay then. You know, I guess I'll wear denim or whatever, but it just feels a little hollow.
It just seems like a little play in one act about how awareness should not be the goal, right? We're all aware, right? Like, everybody's aware.
Yeah, we need to get a little bit beyond that. We need to do something.
All right, well, what's the biggest sex myth that you once believed?
That you can only do it with one person at a time.
Mm, we're going to be talking about that.
You know, nobody had ever mentioned any other possibilities. So that was the way I saw sex represented all the time. That was the only description there ever was. So that's what I thought it was, to have sex.
Well, you definitely are convinced otherwise now, which we will talk about.
Yeah.
And lastly, who's one of the bravest people that you know of who is working to unscrew the sexual culture?
Okay, so I wanted to talk here about like people who are in my own field. So I work in academia and philosophy, which some people like don't realize this, but it's actually really male dominated in statistical terms. Like the number of men working in my field is still more like what you might think of for like a physics department or engineering or something like that than it is like English, which tends to be much more gender balanced. Not surprisingly, given that fact, it has a massive sexual harassment problem that's been going unaddressed for years and years and years. And there are lots of people who've been working so hard and so tirelessly to address that I wanted to give them kind of a little shout out.
Yes, yes.
So I'm going with Sally Haslanger and Jennifer Saul. They're both professors, philosophy professors, and they're excellent philosophy professors. And also on top of that, they're working really hard to unscrew the sexual culture of philosophy in academia. And I really appreciate it. It's inspiring. It's tough. Philosophy has been like this for so long. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, actually, like some of the history of the philosophy of love. It's just been ignoring women's voices for so long that now it's hard. Like, you can't just pick up the history book, the history of philosophy book, and find all the interesting women. If you pick up the history of philosophy book, you'll just find a big list of interesting men.
So let's talk about the philosophy of love. What is love?
The closest I get to an answer is what I call this dual nature theory. Love has biological components and it has a social component. And so the social part, it's basically a social construct. You can think of it like, if you think of gender as a social construct, you could think of romantic love very similarly, right? So romantic love, there's a certain kind of script that's supposed to conform to. You could think of it as like, you know, basically the script for rom-coms. You're supposed to meet someone and it's just one person.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to have really intense feelings and you're supposed to, that's supposed to include like sexual feelings, but also, you know, a lot more than that, a lot of passion, a lot of kind of commitments eventually. And then you're supposed to date for a while and then supposed to get married. You're supposed to have kids and you're supposed to stay together forever, monogamous forever. And then, you know, eventually you die. That's kind of the script for how that's supposed to go. So I want to say like that you don't get that from biology, right? If you look at what we are as biological creatures, as animals, doesn't deliver most of that script. What you get if you look at the biology is a series of neurochemical responses, you know, so like chemistry goes off in our brains, and it's doing that for a reason, right? But this is the part where it gets tricky, because if you're simplistic about that, then you're going to say what's happened is that we evolved to be naturally monogamous, naturally hetero, so that we could reproduce the species, right? That sounds natural, I think, to a lot of people, but it's very easy to confuse nature for culture in these discussions, because what's really familiar to us also sounds natural. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's necessarily biology. Okay. And the problem with attributing too much to the biology here is that picture doesn't really explain what we actually see. We don't actually see, if you look at the whole history of humanity, a general tendency all the time towards monogamous, basically nuclear family structures, right? That's what we see in some places at some times, but other places, other times, we see these maybe polygamous structures. You actually sometimes do see polyandrous as well, structures where one woman has multiple male partners, although those are more unusual, but they're not as unusual as was previously thought. And then again, you might see just sort of large-scale cooperative structures where family units are not the primary way of organizing a society. You also can't attribute to biology a drive towards exclusive hetero relationships, because it doesn't explain the data. It doesn't explain the fact that there's just all these other kinds of relationships that exist, right? Even going against a lot of social pressure not to.
So why is it important, do you think, for us to have a definition or an idea that we all agree on? Or is it, you know, for me, I kind of feel like it's important for the people I love and who love me for us to understand what we mean by that.
Yeah.
Is it important culturally for us to all have the same definition of love?
I don't think so. I mean, so part of what I think love is at this sort of social level, where we create the script, as it were, is a composite image of everybody's picture of love, right? So all of the representations that you see on TV, imagine them being like overlaid over each other, like a composite photograph. And then what emerges from that gives you the big social picture. I think it's actually important for people to disagree, right? At the individual level. That's how you get diversity. It's how you get change. The thing you're putting your finger on is that it is really important to be clear about what you mean by love, if you're going to have a really important conversation about that with somebody that really matters to you. And that's one of the huge problems I'm trying to address with this book, is that we don't have that kind of conversation about what we mean.
And I think part of that issue, and I know you do too, is that the composite that most of us are working off of is very homogenous and very narrow. I mean, I think that with this show running shortly before Valentine's Day, we're at peak homogenous love definition, right? This is the moment where the definition of love seems to feel the narrowest. It doesn't leave a lot of paths to figure out other things that might work better for them. And I feel like I should say, like, if the dominant idea of heteromonogamous romantic love works for you, individual unscrewed listener, like, that's great. Like, this is not an argument against any definition of love, as long as you're not hurting anybody.
Right. That's a definition of, like, your love, but it's not a definition of every kind of love, right? So the worry is when people overproject from what they maybe have experienced in their own lives and then assume that that's what it is for everybody. That's the problem. Just getting to the point where you can even have the conversation enough to notice that there is a disagreement is really important.
So what's your personal definition of love? Can I ask you that? When you say I love you to one of your partners, like, what do you mean?
Here's what I might say is my closest thing to a definition. Bell Hooks has written a book called, well, she's written actually three books on love. The one I'm thinking of here is called All About Love. And so she builds a definition that has lots of ingredients like care and trust and openness, things like that. And she's aiming to get this sort of definition that's inconsistent with abusive relationships, because she says people are at risk in a lot of cases of confusing what's actually abuse for love, thinking that it's love when it's really abuse. And she wants a definition that rules that out. So the closest thing I might say to a definition might be something like what bell hooks gives there. So I'm trying to convey, when I say that to a partner, I'm trying to convey something about, you know, my own like most intense feelings that include like really caring for them, really feeling trusting towards them, really feeling open towards them. But it's also, you know, when I say I love you to a romantic partner, it's not like when I say it to my dog. There's something else there as well, right?
I should hope so.
Yeah, this romantic dimension. And this is where it gets really tricky, because then you have to say what makes love romantic as opposed to some other kind of thing.
And then we're talking about sex in part.
Well, we could be. So, I mean, one of the things I want to flag there is that I don't think that's the only way to make that distinction, because I do believe that like asexual romantic love is possible. So sex becomes like one of these possible ingredients in a romantic love relationship that would help to distinguish it from other kinds of love. But then again, you could have a really good friend with benefits that you love in a friendly way, and you also have sex with, but it's not romance, because that's not the kind of relationship.
Right. You have sex with them and you love them as a friend, but you don't feel those in love feelings.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where it gets really tricky, right?
It is a little ineffable, isn't it?
That's a good word. And so I don't quite try to F it.
We're in favor of people only effing what they want to on this show.
But there's definitely a lot you can do. So one thing I'm really worried about is like going to the opposite extreme and saying, oh, I can't figure it out completely, so I should just like stop thinking about it. That's really dangerous, because that means you're going to turn off your critical thinking skills, and you need those. You really need those to be firing on all cylinders if you're actually falling in love or making decisions about love, because you're naked without them.
Well, I think a lot of hurt comes from our inability to talk about what we individually mean by love and think about love. That, you know, if I say I love you to someone and they say it back and we mean really different things by that and we don't talk about it further, that can cause real pain and risk to people.
Totally. And so, you know, if the only thing that this book were to achieve was the idea that it's important to have that conversation, that would be a total success. I don't really care if anyone believes what I say about it. I really care about people having the conversation for themselves. And I really care about people thinking for themselves about that question.
You talk a little in the book about the resistance to thinking and talking about the question and the idea that it might ruin the magic of love.
Oh, yeah.
We'll talk a little more about that, because I thought that conversation was great. Temperamentally, I want to talk about everything. Like, I don't like to leave. There's like a running joke in my house about my war on subtext. But I get that. Like, I sort of grok it at the same time. The idea that like there are feelings you don't want to like think about too much because they're so lovely. And it does feel sort of magical. And you're afraid you're going to like ruin the magic by thinking and talking about it too much. I mean, I also hear that around sex a lot. You know, mm-hmm, as a sex educator, I'm constantly working against the idea that it's unsexy to talk about sex or it'll ruin the mood or the moment. And I think that's a related idea, which I'm constantly frustrated by.
Right. I feel your pain. I think it's a very similar phenomenon, actually, that, you know, don't think about it because you'll ruin it. Don't talk about it because you'll spoil it. Those are ways of shutting down conversation, which means shutting down like criticism or critique of anything that's going wrong socially. And that, of course, is going to benefit the people who are benefiting most from the current social arrangements. Mm. So people for whom whatever the current sexual and romantic culture is, the people who are really benefiting from that are going to benefit from shutting down any conversation that could reveal the problems with that. And so this is part of why I'm saying it's really important to keep having the conversations. So I call it the romantic mystique, this idea that like romantic love is just magical and wonderful and you can't figure it out. And so you shouldn't try because it's just natural and perfect the way it is. And I'm naming it after, you know, much older idea of the feminine mystique, this idea that women are magical and wonderful and you can't understand them. So, you know, you shouldn't try and they should just kind of accept their nature passively without questioning it. I think those are both really dangerous ideas. And the same is true for sex too, right? You don't just kind of accept it without questioning it. If you do that, you're going to wind up in potentially really bad situations.
Yeah, absolutely. But you don't think it will ruin the magic?
I can say that it's never ruined the magic for me. I can also say this. So some people are worried that if they take a really close look at their love, their romantic relationship, that's going to spoil it. It's going to disappear. And, you know, what I say about that is that something that might disappear if you look at it too hard might not be the best thing to base your most important decisions around. You know, another word for things like that would be an illusion or a trick of the eye. If it wouldn't stand a really close look, then, you know, I'm not sure it's as great as you might think it is. I mean, it's not like there are no risks from that. It's true. You might find out, it might get ugly if you look really close. But if that happens, then that ugliness was always there already. And you just didn't know about it. And that's not better, right?
Right. Looking at it did not create the flaw, whatever it is. And I would also argue that there are real benefits, aside from knowing whether something's unstable, to thinking and talking about this explicitly. You know, for me, I feel like it makes me closer to my partners because we can talk about what we really deeply believe and feel as best as we can. And we really come to understand and trust each other at a different level. Obviously, since I'm a monogamous person, I'm not one of those people who thinks, you know, poly is inherently better. But I do think it requires a kind of thoughtfulness and communication that monogamy, because it's like the default setting from the culture, doesn't inherently ask of people. People aren't even talking about what they mean by monogamy. I'm going to sort of ask back this study because I only vaguely remember it. But I remember reading a study, and maybe you've seen it, that shows that, you know, that asked monogamous couples like what they meant by monogamy, and like, they had really different definitions, right? And but they weren't talking about it because there was just this assumption that comes from that composite rom-com, you know, cultural narrative that like everybody knows what it is and everybody's playing by the same rules. And it's just not so.
You're completely right. Even things you want to label traditional, there's no off the peg model for that. You know, you need to have these conversations, whatever kind of relationship you want to be in.
Absolutely.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So talk to me, you alluded earlier, and I went in a little different direction, but to like the places where biological ideas of love and social construction ideas of love sort of don't line up and what happens in those gaps.
Mm-hmm. So here's one kind of example. The social script says, like, love has to be hetero. No queer love is allowed. In fact, sometimes it's not even sort of on the register as possible. And so in that case, you've got a script that just really doesn't match up with the biological reality of what humans are, right? Which is that they're not uniformly hetero. They are a range of other things as well. And so... over time, that biological mismatch, you can try to like suppress the biology, but what's actually happened is that over time, that the biology's insisted, right? It's just stayed there. We haven't been able to make it go away, despite, you know, some really horrible efforts to...
Here in the U.S., we're on a lot of people's minds because we have a vice president who believes in conversion therapy.
Which is terrifying. So, I mean, this is something that's... it's still kind of quite a potent fear, I think, for me anyway, for a lot of people, that we might be about to take some massive steps backwards on this kind of issue. What's been happening is that we've been molding our social script, which we like collectively have quite a lot of control over, and we need to sort of realize that in order to move it in good directions. But we've been molding it to allow more openness on that question. So we've been kind of including the possibility of queer love in the social script because the biology's been refusing to go away, right? We haven't been able to get rid of it. Right. So we're getting the two to match up together by changing the script. And I think that's great.
Although I always am a little hesitant about biological arguments for queer rights because as a bisexual person, I feel like it could be expected of me that because I have heterosexual attractions that I just adhere to those.
Right.
And also if we discover new things biologically, does that mean we don't have, you know, I feel philosophically, I don't know if I'm even using that word right because you're a professional, but I feel like we can't help it is a less robust argument for civil rights than it's none of your fucking business.
I completely agree with that. I mean, so I think honestly, it's none of your fucking business is the right argument. I'm not even so much looking here at like the moral arguments, but as the history of right. what's happened. Okay, like, yeah, why yeah. did this happen? So attempts to shut down the biology just mm-hmm. didn't work. And so as a pragmatic fact, this is the reason why we came to fit the social script to the biology and stop trying to do the opposite. And now we're kind of in this position where the same kinds of issues are coming up with monogamy, and it's getting more and more pressing because people are living longer, basically, and they're expecting more time out of their permanent monogamous relationships. And they're also, we're sort of gradually catching up with the idea that it's not okay for, say, men to rape their wives. If you're shutting down women's sexual desire in whatever way that might be happening, it's actually going to shut down the entire process. It's not going to be forcible marital sex right. allowed. And this is such a like glacial pace of change that even though the law changed in most places by the 90s, change in practice is a lot slower than change in principle, but we are getting there.
Well, and you know, in the sweep of history, the 90s is like 2 seconds ago.
Right. It's a blink of an eye. Yeah.
Although also, I mean, I believe it's true that love and marriage were not even interlocked concepts until historically recently anyway. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons why I think the social script for romantic love might have come into existence is to create this idea of a kind of love that really distinctively goes with marriage. So one of the things I look at is, you know, ancient Greek society, where there's a lot of philosophy of love going on, right? Plato is really into this stuff, and he was trying to give really careful analysis of different kinds of love, mostly eros, which is sometimes it gets translated as passionate love or a desire. But he's not really presenting it as anything like what we would necessarily call romantic love now. So there's a real question. Did romantic love exist back then? And there wasn't this kind of social script that involves marriage and all these other things. There probably was the same thing going on biologically, right, for a lot of people. The way I sometimes put it is that the biology is like an actor and the social script is like a role that the actor is going to play. So back in ancient Greece, you might well have had the actor on set, but the script wasn't written yet, so didn't get to play that role. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. For there to be any real drama, you need both.
Mm-hmm.
So your book is called What Love Is and What It Could Be. So talk a little bit about the second half of that. What is the idea of love that you'd like to see us moving toward?
Yeah, good. So when I talk about what love could be, I talk about both the social angle and the biological angle, because they're both really important here. So socially, you know, we have a lot of control over the social script. Not any one individual, but we, all of us together, have a lot of control over the script. We could decide to say that you don't have to be hetero to be in love. We can decide to say you don't have to be monogamous to be in love. And we could then start representing a more diverse range of romantic models in culture and art and literature and just in our own lives. And if we did that, the composite image would change, right? We would get a very different social picture of what love is. So what love could be depends on, you know, what we decide to do with that, how we decide to tell our stories, what stories we decide to tell, and what stories we decide to listen to as well, right? Because a lot depends on who's going to pay to go and see a movie that has a certain kind of story.
Right. And it also depends on who the Hollywood bosses think will go pay.
Yes, that too. Right?
Which is not the same as who will go pay.
Not the same, absolutely. So yeah, part of this is about making clear what we do and don't value, right? What stories we do and don't want to hear, trying to transmit that information as much as possible. So that's all like on the social level. And what I would love to see there is just more inclusiveness. I don't want to see anything ruled out, but I want to see much more ruled in. I want to see asexual love represented. I want to see a lot more kinds of queer love represented, and I want to see more non-monogamous love represented. And I want those things to become normal, not weird.
That when Highlights, have you been following this thing with Highlights?
No.
It's a magazine for kids. It's really exciting because like you're a kid and you get a magazine delivered to the house with your name on it and you feel super adult. And they recently, under pressure, depicted a same-sex family, just like inside, because they have cartoons and things in it, obviously. They included an image of a same-sex family in a story that wasn't mm-hmm. about being same-sex. It was just there they were. And there's, you know, this huge conservative hue and cry. There's like this million moms who are never a million. Just don't be fooled by the name. That's the organization name are like boycott highlights and this is propaganda. Mm-hmm. So in your, I think in our shared vision of what love should be or could be, that image would be included and no one would remark upon it, right? It would be right. just normal.
It would just be normal. And, you know, it also reminds me of the, do you remember the hullabaloo about that Old Navy ad recently? I think that must have been last year.
Yeah.
Where there was, I think there was a black guy and a white woman and a kid.
Yes.
And they were, you know, modeling as a family. And there was this massive outcry. And I mean, that one just really kind of makes me tear my hair out because this is a very old problem that that we're still trying to fix in what kinds of love we're willing to accept as being normal and unremarkable. So that's all on the social side. But I also do want to think about like what love could be biologically, because there's this tendency to think, well, if it's in your biology, it's natural, then you're stuck with it. You can't change that. That's just the way it is, which is interesting because we don't really think like that about biology in lots of other respects. Like if you have, you know, a biological illness, you don't just think, oh, well, what a shame, I'm going to die or I'm going to... You try to cure that. You try to change your biology so that you get better. This idea that we're just stuck with biology and we can't possibly change anything on that front is weird and a mistake. So part of what I try to do towards, like in the later sections of the book, is start thinking more about some of the ways that people are already starting to talk about biological interventions in love. So different kinds of, for example, chemical interventions that might be used to try to promote staying in love with someone you are with, or in some cases to try to reduce the feelings associated with being in love with someone you need to leave, someone you need to get away from.
It's funny, the first one feels creepy to me and the second one sounds so useful.
Here's the problem. They can both be super creepy if
right.
they're used in creepy ways.
Yes.
And so, you know, what really matters as soon as you get down those roads is to examine the ideology behind the biology. People who are arguing, for example, that we should use chemistry to get people to stay together, some of them are doing that in the context of saying, well, it's good for children if there's less divorce, so we should use chemical interventions to keep couples together so that they stay together for the children. And so, you know, immediately then I want to ask, well, is it good for the people if the people who would have left each other?
Yes.
If it wasn't for the drugs they were on.
I'm really worried about the gendered uses of these. A new kind of mother's little helper.
That's exactly the analogy that I want to draw. Yeah. And it's, you know, this attempt to sort of paper over a problem that then goes unaddressed. I think the same thing about some of these sort of, you know, flibanserin and ways of trying to say that, like, if women's sexuality has shut down, then we should try to give them, you know, drugs and counseling and not look at the social factors behind what's happening there that could be causing that. It's a large scale problem, right? You must know the studies of monogamous hetero women are losing desire at a much higher rate than monogamous hetero men in long-term relationships, right?
You know, when my last book came out, this was 6 years ago, admittedly, I spent about a week as a guest expert on I think it was Cafe Moms. It was a website for women on message boards. And they could ask me questions and I would just chat with them. And literally over and over again got asked the same question, which is, I've lost my desire to have sex with my husband. Yeah. Can you tell me what the biological fix for that is?
Yeah.
And it made me so sad. Like, the biological fix for that is, like, for your husband to care about your sexual pleasure and for you to feel safe with him and not feel like you're doing twice the work. Right? Like, and which is not to say that there aren't biological libido issues individual,
sure.
separate from those factors, but I think we would find way fewer, right?
Right. When it's a pattern on this scale,
yes.
it can't be that every individual woman is broken, right? The impact on women's libido of the patriarchy, you can't fix that by medicating them, the women.
No, exactly. You have to fix the patriarchy. Otherwise, it's like basically medical gaslighting.
It is. And I mean, it's a form of victim blaming because you're identifying as the problem, the person who is actually not creating the problem, but suffering from it. And then you're doing something that, even if it works occasionally or for individuals, it's only going to be papering a symptom and it's not going to address the root cause.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I know this is not your field, but do you have any advice for listeners who are feeling really alienated by this narrow narrative right now during the Valentine season? Have you got any parting words for them?
Yes. And actually, they're kind of like parting words for me, too, because I don't fit the narrative. I'm a poly woman and openly in two relationships. And so actually, a lot of the reason for writing this book is trying to figure out whether I count as being in love, given that fact. Is this really romantic love, whatever I'm doing? For anyone who's kind of not conforming to the mold, what I end up saying in the book is you're changing the world by not conforming to the mold, and very literally changing the world. You're changing the social world, the social construct of romantic love, which is this product of all of the different models that we're all generating all the time. So every time one person does something that doesn't look like the script, they're adding their own layer to the composite image. And enough people keep doing that, and the composite image changes. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with not conforming to the script. It's literally changing the world. But I really understand, because I've been there, that the costs of doing that all fall on you, and you become a rebel whether or not you want to be one. If you're not conforming, the world makes you a rebel. I know how hard that is, and these aren't exactly words of comfort. These are just words of been there. Yeah,
I actually think that's lovely. That's wonderful. I feel comforted. Well, thank you so much for helping us think through this stuff. The book again is called What Love Is and What It Could Be. It's available everywhere, more or less. Yes.
Yes, I hope so.
Okay. And if it's not at your bookstore, go ask for them to get it in. Carrie, are you doing events for it? Where can people follow your work in general? Let us know how people can connect.
Yeah, I'm doing a couple of events around Valentine's Day. I'll be in Portland on the 13th of February, Seattle on the 14th of February. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carrie Jenkins. I'm also on Facebook as Carrie Ichikawa Jenkins. It's my middle name, Ichikawa.
Fantastic. And you can also find me on Twitter at Jacqueline F, J-A-C-L-Y-N-F. On Facebook there as well. On Instagram, I'm Jacqueline Effable. If you want to continue the conversation, come talk to Carrie and I about how you experience love and how you think about love and how you talk to partners about love. Use the hashtag Unscrewed, use our handles, and we would love to jump in that conversation with you. You can find the show notes for this and all the past episodes of Unscrewed at my website, which is jacquelinefriedman.com. Friedman is F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. You can also find writing and upcoming events for me and all kinds of other stuff there. Please email me at unscrewed@jacquelinefriedman.com with requests for future topics or future guests, and also with your sex and sexuality related advice questions that I can get answered by myself and future guests. You can find this show wherever fine podcasts are available: iTunes, Acast, Stitcher. Make sure you subscribe so you won't miss an episode. When you're in iTunes, if you want to share the show, you want to make sure other people find us, please, please give us 5 stars. Give me a little 2-sentence review. It makes a big difference. The show is produced and edited by yours truly. Our in and out music is by the Pink Tiles. Our cover art is by Nicole Dodonna and was designed in collaboration with The Establishment, who also designed the sound cues. Until next week, I'm wishing you all safe and happy sex lives.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.